an American also here, and as the Dean of the Jerusalem College for Adults and the Director of Education at the Israel Center, so many people know him in Yerushalayim, and we're very fortunate that he comes and speaks to us as well. So he's going to share some words of wisdom tonight. I don't know exactly what the title means, but whatever it is, I think we'll all think clearer and see clearer when he's done speaking. Rabbi Dr. Shalom Gold.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Weiss. First, I'm really impressed with the fact that you are able to remember the names and the titles of the lecturers for the next 4 weeks. Interesting, of course, is that Richard Joel is going to be in my shul Shabbos the 15th, and then he's going to be here the 17th. And then you have Dan Kurtzer. So let me tell you a story about Dan and Richard. How do you like that? First name basis, you'll understand. His Excellency Dan and the president of Yeshiva University, a number of months ago, the member of my shul made a wedding, and by the chuppah, Richard Joel was sitting next to Dan Kurtzer, and I walk by, and I hear Richard Joel telling Dan Kurtzer, "If Rabbi Gold sees me sitting next to you, he'll never let me into his shul again." Okay. I assured Richard that he may come to my shul, and I even said, "Dan, you'll come, we'll give you hagba, it's all right, we'll take care of you." I say they sort of sensed that I don't see eye to eye with Dan Kurtzer, His Excellency. Maybe by the end of this year, you may even know why I don't see eye to eye with Dan Kurtzer. One of the classic texts of Jewish ethics is the Mesilat Yesharim, the Path of the Just, written by Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. It's a classic, classic work. Now, I remember in yeshiva we started learning, or were we being taught Mesilat Yesharim, or were we supposed to study it on our own? It must have been about 15, 16 years old, and we didn't appreciate it. We didn't really understand it. And I think it was a waste then, except for 1 year that I had a Rebbe who taught us Mesilat Yesharim. So that was better. Now, in the event that somebody has the good fortune later in life to pick it up and start learning the Mesilat Yesharim, it's a treasure. It's a treasure. It even comes in English translation. A good friend of mine translated it. I just want to learn with you one paragraph in the Mesilat Yesharim, and from there we're going to take off. The lecture is going to be based on one little bit of Mesilat Yesharim, and it may end, if I get through everything I want to say, it's going to end with another line of the Mesilat Yesharim. He says the following. Our rabbis say, "Toshet choshech v'yehi laila." It's dark and it's night. Zeh ha'olam azeh, that's this world. Shedoma l'layla. This world is like night, says the Mesilat Yesharim. For Havain, and he says, understand how amazing are these words of our rabbis, that this world is night. Havain kamonifla ha-mamar ha-amiti hazed, this true statement, l'misha mamik la-havinbo, for the person who's going to deeply study this statement. Because he says that darkness of night can cause man to make one of two mistakes. Mistake number one is, it's dark. I can't see. And because I can't see, or it is difficult to see, I'm going to make mistakes. I don't know what's ahead of me. I can't make out in the darkness what kind of pitfalls may be there before me. Then again, also, in the dark, person may see a pillar, and he thinks it's a human being. Or he sees a human being and he thinks it's a pillar. Darkness simply makes it very, very difficult to see. That's one problem. Then he says, but there's a second and a far, far more serious problem with darkness, the inability to see, the second mistake. That's more difficult than the first. Where a person can see, but there's something wrong with his vision. Nothing physical wrong with his vision, but there's something intellectually wrong with his vision. A person sees something that's bad, and he thinks, this is real good. And he sees something good, and to him, this is terrible. He's all mixed up. Up here. Now, there's a physical darkness which creates blindness. I can't see the road ahead. It's dark. There's another kind of blindness which is intellectual. It's the mind. I just don't see things right. He says that second one is far, far more difficult than the first. I would imagine because the first... What happens if all of a sudden there's going to be a burst of light so the fellow's going to be able to see? Oh, he can see what's standing in his way. He knows now how to watch out, how to be careful, where to walk, where not to walk. The second fellow, you can have all the spotlights in the world on the road ahead. It doesn't make any difference. The problem is in his head. He sees good as bad, and bad as good. I'm going to get to the point, because the point is going to be a point throughout the shiur. I'm going to be using examples, and there are a lot of examples that you'll be able to think of in life. But let's use the political process of the last 11 years as our example. If people are unaware of the facts, that's like the darkness of night. I don't know the facts. I mean, I assume such and such is true, and therefore I keep marching merrily along, and then little by little I begin to find out that there's a problem here, and there's a problem there, there's a hole over there, a pitfall over there, all sorts of things that you begin to find out. There are those who thought at the beginning of the process, this is it. It's the dawn of a new day. Everything is going to be good from now on and further. We're going to live side by side with our partners, with our friends. 100 years of enmity is over. Our grandchildren will not have to go to the army. It's going to be a new world. It's going to be a new world. But then... as it starts going and the light begins to shine, the darkness is dispelled, you begin to see there are a lot of problems. This isn't simple. This isn't simple at all. But then there's a second kind of darkness. That second kind of darkness, that second kind of blindness, is a blindness where people simply have a completely different view of things. And when they have a completely different view of things, it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult to talk them out of it. Yes, if they feel that maybe we stole the land, maybe we really owe a great deal to our neighbors. Maybe we, who others see as the victims, we're really the perpetrators of a terrible crime, and we have to make good on that. There are people who do think differently than I do anyway, and I even think that there are people who think differently than Rabbi Weiss does. I think it must be like that. So here we have two kinds of darkness. One is a technical one. One is technical. It's dark. I can't see. I can't see. I make mistakes. The second is not darkness. Not darkness at all. but rather a view, call it, if you will, a philosophy that makes things completely topsy-turvy. The first fellow may know that he's in the dark and he's waiting to see the light. The second believes that he's in the light. The second believes that he knows what's the light, and all of those fellas all around who disagree with him, Nebuch, they know not what they say. These are the two forms of darkness about which the Mesilat Yesharim, the Moshe Chaim Lutzato, speaks. Now, both of these forms of blindness descended upon the political leadership and large segments of the population on the day of the handshake on the White House lawn. That was Monday, September 13th, 1993. The Declaration of Principles, more commonly known as the Oslo Accords, burst onto the scene, and they have dominated our lives for the past 11 years. And as we said, there were people who saw the dawn of a new day, an end to 100 years of hostility in one stroke. Arafat, Zolohovina, Shainim Gehenim, in one stroke. Arafat was elevated from world-class gangster, the Don of modern terrorism, to respected statesman and partner in the peace of the brave. The man of war became the very manifestation of the man of peace. The olive branch replaced the gun, and Israeli politicians were falling all over each other to be seen with him, to have a picture taken with him. The air was festive, festooned with balloons. People were eating hummus in Yericho with Palestinians. Peace and harmony was breaking out all over the place. It was finally the lamb and the lion who were lying down together. Nations vied with each other to host the great Palestinian Bolivar, the one who was going to bring into being an independent state. The father of a soon-to-be nation, the White House was wide open to him. I can talk for myself, and I'm sure for many of you, our hearts were breaking from disbelief and pain. How could anybody believe that terrorists were going to take up arms against fellow Palestinians, and they were going to kill fellow Palestinians in order to save Jews from terrorism? It was unbelievable. And just yesterday, Abu Mazen said, I will never lift a gun against the Pharaoh Arab. By the way, it's an extremely noble position that the man took. I wouldn't have expected any less of him. And they thought that, as Rabin at the time said, that Arafat will be able to take care of terror without a Supreme Court standing in his way. And people believed it. People believed it. We lived with the thought that this is all a bad dream, it's a nightmare, that any day now will end and we're going to go back to living our lives normally. We were appalled to learn that even within our Orthodox community there were those who looked with favor upon that which we saw as impending doom. We stood on the highways at major intersections. We held up signs, Al titnu lehem rovim, don't give them guns. We demonstrated, we petitioned, we faxed, we emailed, we wrote, we spoke, we argued, we debated, all to no avail. The people minding the state knew a great deal better than we did what was good for us. Darkness had descended, blindness prevailed. Unfortunately, only exploding buses, drive-by shootings, suicide bombers, and all-out war began to beat sense into some of our people. The two forms of blindness that the Mesilat Yesharim speaks about were clearly manifest. The man in the street really thought that was on the, we were on the threshold of a new era. He mistakenly saw a killer as man and murderer as partner. Far more dangerous is what the Mesilat Yesharim says is the second form of blindness. Those whose blindness was intellectual and ideological, the politicians, the authors, the playwrights, the professors, the sundry adherents of post-Zionism who practice revision of Jewish history. They see Israel as the arch-villain who stole Palestinian land and created a state on their Nakba, their catastrophe. They, on the whole, are unrepentant even now to this day. I want to now elaborate on the words of the Mesilat Yesharim, and I have been finding other forms of blindness, the kind of blindness that the Mesilat Yesharim could never have imagined, because it staggers the imagination. There was a third kind of blindness. And you'll see right away it's a blindness that we're in the middle of right now, all over again. There was a third kind of blindness that even Rav Moshe Chaim Litzato could never have imagined, because it's so irrational and defies definition. It's a blindness that's self-imposed, carefully planned, and executed with a strange and eerie kind of perfection. I'll tell you what I call it. I call it turning a blind eye. I saw somebody use recently the term willful blindness. I choose to be blind. The choosing to be blind is our people became the great apologists for Arafat and the Palestinians. If he spoke in Johannesburg, the famous, we're in a South African synagogue, aren't we? There was the famous, or the infamous, Johannesburg mosque speech of Arafat. I think it was Basil Platsky. You don't know Basil Platsky, but I do. He got that tape to somebody at the airport who brought it to Eretz Israel. And we hear a speech by Arafat right there in Johannesburg, calling for jihad until Jerusalem is ours. I mean, it was clear. It was clear what he was saying over there. He repudiated only a few months after signing the Oslo Accords, he was repudiating it all. He then referred to the Mohammed himself, who had made the pact of 10 years with the Quraysh tribe, and 2 years later he broke it all. So of course, jihad. What he means is a jihad of peace. Our people became his apologists. We chose to turn a blind, or they chose to turn a blind eye. I remember I pleaded with people then. People on the left, if you want to give Oslo a chance of success, you know what you should do? At the very first violation, stop. Dead in its tracks, stop. Let him know what your phone number is. When he's ready to correct the violation, we'll go to the next step. 10,000, 12,000 police became 40,000. Sidearms and rifles became... who knows what kind of weapons they were bringing in? Most probably already... they were building tunnels while we had tunnel vision, you understand? They were bringing it in all over the place. And who were the apologists? Was it yesterday in the paper or today about Abu Mazen's speech on Shabbos? Well, he's talking, it's election time. He has to say what he's saying. He has to say what, don't you understand? He really is a partner for peace. He's gonna kill Hamas guys. He's gonna be the great hero of the Jewish people. But during elections, are Israeli politicians know that you lie through your teeth during elections? So why shouldn't he lie? turning a blind eye. Choosing to be blind. It's unbelievable. Rabbi Shechem Litzato could never have dreamt of anything of the sort. For years they were apologizing. There were times that tremendous pressure after a pigua, there was tremendous pressure brought that he should condemn it. You remember it all the time, every time, condemn it. And finally, after some pigua, there was a condemnation, and then it turned out, well, that was only in English, but for his own people in Arabic, it was different. It was unbelievable. We chose to be blind. With the arrival of Arafat and his gang of fellow terrorists at the very outset of the implementation, the violations began right then. You know what you forgot? I know what you forgot. I nearly forgot it. The very first commitment that he made was to change the Palestinian covenant that calls for the destruction of the Jewish state. Do you think it was ever amended? It was ever changed? Trust me. Ad Hayom Hazeh, after dozens of times, yes, they're meeting, it's in committee, they're changing it. And then at one point, Peres said it, it's really not important. It's not important anymore because we're partners in peace now. It's only a technical matter. What do you mean it's a technical matter? Nothing ever changed. The first commitment was never ever kept. They even brought Clinton here for some kind of a phony thing in Gaza, whereby raising their hands they are supposed to have changed the covenant. Trust me, you can believe me, the covenant is bidiyuk what it always was. We had warned in September of 93, we had warned that the Palestinian areas, those areas that will be given to them, are going to turn into cities of refuge. That's exactly what happened. There were terrorist attacks. They'd flee back to the Palestinian areas. And then started the game. They were arrested. They're being jailed. They're going to be brought on trial. And then a few days later, you find out that they went in one door of the jail and went out the other. It was an embarrassing game for the government, and the government didn't do anything about it. It was a maddening period of time. It's getting more maddening. Any self-respecting country would have immediately frozen all contracts and agreements until there would be full compliance. I don't know if you noticed, there was a letter to the editor in the Jerusalem Post about 2 months ago. I noticed this one because I know the fellow who wrote it. There are all sorts of missiles that are falling on Gush Katif and Sderot and other places. And at one point, somebody, one of the residents of Gush Katif, had made the statement that the government doesn't really mind. So our prime minister said, only a sick mind could have said something like that. So a Dr. Oppenheim from Yerushalayim, who's a top psychiatrist in the country, said, I don't know too much about politics, but I certainly know about sick minds. There is the single country in this world where bombs would be falling that they wouldn't go in with all the force that they have and crush it utterly. That's a sick mind. I don't know, every time we destroy a few tunnels, there are more tunnels. I'm amazed that Gaza doesn't just collapse into the earth, you understand? I don't know why. A blindness of turning a blind eye. Willful blindness. But that's not the end of blindness. By the way, talk about turning a blind eye, it doesn't have to be only in the political realm. A few weeks ago, a fellow lives on my block, made a wedding. I came into the wedding. I tell you, I was horrified. I was horrified. I went and I found the father of the chusin. I wished him mazel tov and I ran out. The smoke of people smoking was so overwhelming, I couldn't breathe. I simply couldn't breathe. Anybody who in this day and age is able to smoke is willfully blind. They don't read what's on the package. They don't read what it says in the ad. They're turning a blind eye. I was horrified. Sitting, I wanted to give a clap of intish and say, I don't know, you know, I decided that they think I'm a nut already anyway, so I'll just disappear from the scene. I simply couldn't breathe. That's not turning a blind eye. I mean, we know what foods are good for us. We know what foods are bad for us. We know that we should be doing more exercise. We should be doing stretching. We should be doing weightlifting. We should be doing walking. We know it. And that's not going to happen. Everything is okay. Nothing is going to happen to us. That's a willful form of blindness. There's a fourth kind of blindness. And this one, I believe, the Silat Yesharim could never have thought about this one. Wouldn't have occurred to him. Because he would have assumed that this is a given. In every struggle, in any venture, doesn't have to be a struggle. Before you go into a venture, a business venture, a shidduch, you know what you have to do? You have to find out as much as you can about the other side. Of course, that's first to find out how much they're worth. You understand? That's number one. I mean, that goes without saying. You have to find out how much they're worth. Right. Then, of course, depending on what kind of community one comes from, there's always going to be the question, do they, God forbid, ever use paper dishes on Shabbos? Then it's all over. That's all. You can't even consider that. What kind of tablecloth? Do they put a plastic over the tablecloth? Well, in Gunish, there's nothing to talk about. I mean, there are all sorts of requirements that people have of the machatunim. In a shidduch, you find out whatever you can about the machatunim. Is he a jailbird? Did he ever sit in tfisa, as they would say in Yiddish? I mean, what's the machatanis like? I mean, this is extremely important. And there's a whole science to how you find out as much information as possible about the other side. And if you begin to find out information that sort of doesn't seem to be too good, you know what you do? You find a nice way to bow out of the shidduch. You're going into a business deal with somebody. By the way, the Shulchan Aruch says clearly, if you're going to ask somebody about a potential business partner and you know information about this fellow, you have a responsibility to say it, and you can't become firm and say, I'm not going to say Lashon Hara. The guy's an embezzler. He's a ganef. But I can't say Lashon Hara. I can't tell this poor fellow who's going to invest $1 million with him. Nonsense! Shulchan Aruch says, you have to tell the guy, fellas are gamas, don't give a penny to him. You have to know something about your partner. I don't think we've learned a thing about our partners. I don't think our political leaders have learned a thing about their partners, this partner. Anybody who's taken out a little bit of time, all you need to do is read one or two books by Bernard Lewis and then read Samuel P. Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. And you know what you're going to find out? Samuel P. Huntington, in a book that has become, for most of the governments in the world, a Bible lahavdil. He talks, there are seven major civilizations in the world, Christianity, Islam, Buddha, Zen, Chvei. And of all of them, he proves, page after page, the least likelihood of democracy making inroads isn't the world of Islam. It's just not part of their language. It's not part of their religion. Islam, if we would know what Islam believes in, then we would know what we're dealing with. They're the shidduch. They are the partner. I mean, if anybody's taken Islam 101, then you know that the world is divided into two geographic areas. Dar el-Salam and Dar el-Harb. Dar el-Salam means land that's held by Islam. All other land on the face of this earth is called Dar el-Harb, from the word cherev, sword, land that we have to fight for. There is no such thing, I mean, to use a Talmudic rabbinic term about Eretz Yisrael, it said, Kidsho l'shata, when it was sanctified for its time, it was Kidsho l'osid lover, it became sanctified for all time. In Islam, the halacha is any land that was ever held by Islam remains theirs into eternity. They will never, ever relinquish one piece of land. They'll wait 1,000 years until they can get it. The three great religions. Christianity believes in proselytizing, turning the world into Christians. Jews, live and let live. Whatever you want to. You can be a Christian and still have a chelek in the world to come, a share in the world to come. Islam, the mitzvah of Islam is struggle. Jihad is a basic part of Islam. There has to be struggle and there has to be conquest. It's all basic. Like by us, Laharul, there's Shmira Shabbos and there's Kashrus. By them, it's conflict and struggle until ultimate victory. Anybody who studies and gets to know what Islam is all about understands that any talk about a partnership is sheer madness. It can't be. The only thing you can ever hope for is some kind of a ceasefire for a number of years. The only thing we can hope for is to remain strong. Otherwise, the fact is that we're a miracle. We're a miracle. That this little country over here survives, surrounded by 100 million, I don't know, it's already 200 million, 300 million Muslims. It's unbelievable. They could cast your shalom walk all over us. How do you go into a partnership? How do you go into a shidduch? How do you go into a business deal with somebody that you don't know what makes him tick? Anybody who's going to just do a little study, do yourself a favor. Yeah, The Crisis of Islam by Bernard Lewis will tell you a great deal. By the way, I came across a beautiful paragraph. It's really a chapter, but in that chapter, one fascinating paragraph. He goes through the names of all of the Arab countries in the world. And as he describes each one, most of the names that they have were given to them by colonial powers, either the French or the British. Syria, Lebanon, these are not Arab names. The only one that has an Arab name is Egypt, but there isn't a single Egyptian living in Egypt because there are no Egyptians on the face of this earth. And then he says, and he just says it as a matter of fact. I mean, I'm going to say it with so much feeling, but he says it simply. There's only one country in the world where it's the same people, the same religion, the same language, the same name, in the same place. Israel. No other people on the face of this earth have that uniqueness. We're the same religion, we're the same people, we're speaking the same language, we're in the same place. They consider us foreigners and strangers, you understand, in this world, in this part of the world. We're Naya Gekimina. Anyone know what that means in Yiddish?
neue Gekommene, newcomers, new arrivals, greener. We're the neue Gekommene. And we're not the neue Gekommene. We're the only always Gekommene, the ones that were always here. I was just looking at yesterday. Rav Soloveitchik says, this week's Seder, it just occurs to me now. This week's Seder says, Ela Shmos, these are the names of the children of Israel, Haboim Mitzrayim, who are coming into Egypt. This same pasuk was said twice in Parashat Vayigash when they arrived. So the Rav asks, what are you talking about? In Parashat Vayigash, when it says, these are the names of the children of Israel, Haboim, who are coming to Egypt, it's because they're coming then. The beginning of Parashat Shmos is 100 years later. So he says, you know what Torah is telling us? We can be in a country 1,000 years, and we're Naya Gekimina, we just came now. We never integrate into the society. They're always going to look at us as the strangers, regardless of how much effort we're going to make to become part of, parcel of that people. They're going to look at us as the foreigners, the strangers, the greenhorns, haboyim. That is the Jewish condition. That's the fate, maybe even more the destiny of the Jewish people. So the fourth kind of blindness is our, we didn't check out the machatonim. We just didn't check them out. We don't know what makes them tick. We've turned a blind eye here as well. We should know. It should be basic and fundamental. We have to know what they believe. You know, it means anybody who knows about the Muslim religion knows there is no such thing as land for peace. We've been told now for 11 years, land for peace, land for peace. There's no such thing, no such thing. It can't be. It never will be. Because whatever we give, they want the rest. They want it all. Dar el Harb. They want it all. And then, maybe also, Abba Iban's oft-quoted statement, the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, is nonsense. They never missed a single opportunity. If they chose not to take a deal, you know why they chose not to take it? Because it goes against everything they believe in. They're not going to agree to anything unless it's all that they want. They haven't missed a single opportunity. I have another form of blindness. There's a great vort, and I think I once said it in a shir in a different context here. There's a great vort from Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message, a Canadian. And I remember seeing this. How did I get to see this Marshall McLuhan? Some years ago, I decided to clean off my desk. Every few years, I decide that I'm going to clean my desk. So, on my desk, I think it was 1993, 1994, I see a calendar from 1986. From 1986, I have a calendar from 1986. I decide, the 1986 calendar, into the garbage. I threw it in. Wait, let me take another look. You know, I took it out of the garbage can, and I opened it up. And it's one of these calendars that every page has an aphorism, if it's a good vort. I opened it up to a page, and there's a vort from Marshall McLuhan. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. I'm going to say it again, and it's going to go into your kishkis very easily, understand? But you have to let it go in. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. We're taught from childhood on, seeing is believing. Comes this going in Marshall McLuhan, and he says, no, it's not so. Believing is seeing. I look at the world on the basis of what I believe. And I'll see things differently than others will see it. I want to go one step further. I want to take off on Marshall McLuhan. You can't see unless you believe. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Our secular politicians, who have very little respect for religion, because they have jettisoned Yahadut, cannot understand and are unable to appreciate a partner who does have religious beliefs that are holy to him. The secular person feels that, listen, we can do away with Shabbos, we can do away with kashrus. Ah, so the Muslims have a few mitzvahs here and there. They can also, get a heter, you understand. We'll find a Muslim who'll give them a heter. You can't see unless you believe. If you want to understand the mind of an antagonist who is a believer and you're not a believer, you can't understand him. You can't appreciate him. You don't know where he's coming from. You can't respect what it is that he believes so deeply, because you don't believe deeply at all. You've been able to take a religion of 4,000 years from Avraham Avinu, by virtue of which we returned here, only by virtue of that, and thrown it to the winds. Shabbos, feh. Kashrus, feh. If you don't believe, you can't see. And in another blindness, if you don't believe, you can't see. That's my takeoff. Takeoff on McLuhan, the architects of Oslo, were all secular, non-observant, non-believing Jews who are incapable of understanding the depth of Muslim religiosity. Having themselves abandoned Judaism and possessing a negative attitude toward religion, they were simply, and they are until today, simply unable to perceive a truth that should have been staring them in the face. And even today, those who do not believe are still at a distinct disadvantage. They simply don't inhabit the same world of religious devotion as their enemies do. And they can't therefore see the reality of the situation. A Chumayid is able to see the reality far, far better than a secular politician, regardless of how brilliant he may be. It's depressing to know that at this particular moment in history, the possibility of a lasting peace is not a real option. But on the other hand, once we know it, then we can prepare ourselves for the eventualities of what the future holds for us. I have a fifth and a sixth kind of blindness. And with that, we'll close. But it'll take a few minutes. Nishtarei shnel. The fifth kind of blindness is more pervasive and more destructive than all of the rest. Some people don't see. You know why they don't see? Because they don't look. There are the people who are disinterested, indifferent. I'll just tell you, when this came just hitting me in the face, I was in the States in June to speak about Aliyah. And I'm sitting in my favorite breakfast nook, and I'm reading the paper, and I see a picture of Tali Chatuel and her four daughters gunned down and executed. And I'm sitting there, and pushing tears are coming down my face. It cracked me up completely. To my right, there's a fellow co-religionist reading the financial section of the paper. To my right, is a fellow co-religionist who's reading the sports page. We all have the same newspaper. Nobody bothered. To my right and to my left, they didn't look at that picture. And if they would have looked at that picture, I doubt very much whether they would have been... the truth is, for a moment, I got embarrassed. They'll see me push it. A grown man is crying. And then I said, to heck with them. Let them see me crying. I took out my handkerchief and I said, there are Jews, it may be difficult to believe, but there are Jews who are indifferent. Indifferent. And the indifference, by the way, can be for many reasons. The indifference may even be a religious indifference. Listen, this is Ritzon Hashem, this is what the Rebbe Hashem wants, and that's what happens, and let's go our merry way, we're not going to bother with it all. That's the worst kind of blindness of all. Terrible blindness. There are those who are not involved, they're not interested, they're caught up in their own lives, they don't turn to look at the situation here. A number of times I spoke to groups in the United States, I told them, listen, you have to go online and read Arut Sheva. You have to know what's going on every day in Eretz Yisrael. How can you go through a day? And by the way, you do find many Jews who are tuned in over there, not like they are here. And you'll find Jews over here that are not tuned in as well. It's amazing. But I'm telling you, it's true. Jews are just go about their business, whatever the government does, let them do it. That's an Islamic business. We can't afford to be blind. We have to know the truth. We have to face it. I've come up with a sixth. Just over the last week, last 4 days, 5 days, I came up with a sixth kind of blindness, and that's going to be the... with that, we're going to close. But I need to just take you on a quick journey through the few parashiyot that we learned. Miketz, Vayigash, Vayichi. There's something very significant. In Parashat Vayigash, it says that when Binyamin is brought before Yosef, Tzofnat Paneah, for the first time, they don't know that he's Yosef. And he sees... Binyamin says he wants to cry. Nichmeru Rachmav. And Rashi records a conversation that takes place between them. And he says, tell me something about you. And Rashi says that he told him that he has ten children. He has 10 children. Here it is. And he tells him the name of the names of the children, and they're very strange names. So he asks him, what's the meaning of these names? So Binyamin tells him that the meaning of these names, they all represent my brother. Shalom, Tzofnat Paneach asks him, do you have a brother? He says, yes, I had a brother. I don't know where he is. Do you have children? Yes, I have 10. And what are their names? Yosef asks him. And he tells him, Bela, Becha, Ashbel, all the rest. Very strange names. What's the nature of these names? So he says, Kulam al Shem Achi. All of them are named after the suffering of my brother. Bela, Shenivla Ben Homos. He was swallowed up amongst the nations of the world. Becher, he was the firstborn to his mother. So on. And then he has a son called Chupim. Listen to Rashi. Chupim. So Binyamin tells Tzofnat Paneach, Shelo ro'o chupati, he didn't see my chupa, Velo ra'iti et chupato, and I didn't see his chupa. Very fascinating what Rashi said. Which does he... We would have thought that Binyamin would say, I feel so terrible, my brother was not at my wedding. That's not what he says. He says first, you know what bothers him so much, what he's pained at, that his brother couldn't see his chuppah. Only second to that is that I didn't see his. Do you know what Binyamin is saying? He feels the pain of his brother. He didn't see my chuppah. I know that he would have wanted to be at my chuppah. And he didn't see my chuppah. There's going to be an idea now. Watch. I'm going to take you one after another. Yehuda is standing in the presence of Yosef, and he says, he tells him, I can't go home without that boy. I am the one. I have guaranteed away my Olam Haba and my Olam Hazeh. I'm going to lose everything if I come home without that boy. I've mortgaged it all away. I'll have no Olam Hazeh, no Olam Haba. Yosef is not moved. The last sentence that Yehuda says is, Eich ele el avi, how can I go up to my father without the boy? Pen ed ebara, lest I see the evil that's going to be for my father. Oh! This is the moment at which Yosef can no longer control himself. Up until that time, Yehuda was talking about his own loss, his own pain. All of a sudden, Yosef hears he's talking about the Tata's pain. That's amazing, the Tata's pain. There's another Rashi in Vayigash. Yosef and Binyamin, when they finally know each other, they embrace and they cry. So Rashi says, Binyamin is crying because he knows that the Mishkan Shiloh that is in the geographic area of Yosef is going to be destroyed. And Yosef is crying about the two Batei Migdash that are going to be in the area of Binyamin. They're not crying about their own losses. Each one is crying about the other's loss because he understands the pain of the other. And then there's an amazing Rashi. Rashi says that when Yaakov comes to Mitzrayim, Yosef gets on his chariot and he goes to greet his father. And it's an unbelievable Rashi. Vayera el Aviv, and he appeared to his father. And Rashi says he came so that his father should see him. And that's really how you have to explain it. Vayera el Aviv, he appeared before his father so his father should see him. Well, what's Rashi talking about? Yosef didn't see his father for 22 years. He wants desperately to see his father. His father hasn't seen him for 22 years. He desperately wants to see Yosef. And Rashi says, do you know why Yosef goes riding out there? Do you know what's more important to him than his own seeing his father? His father should see him. He's tuned in to somebody else's pain. I'll tell you, this country went crazy last week. Country went crazy last week because people in Gush Katif started wearing an orange tie. Okay? All of the great defenders of the Shoah went crazy. And I beg to differ. They made one terrible mistake. Article by Shevach Weiss, who is the Yoshev Rosh of Yad Vashem. Unbelievable article. He begins by saying what a desecration it is to use the Star of David, the patch of the Star of David, to advance political motives. The residents of Gush Katif are advancing political motives, or are they fighting for their homes that they've built over 25, 30 years? Political motives? They want political points? Or do they want to defend their homes? Unbelievable. In the very next paragraph, paragraph 2 of Shevach Weiss's great article, he says, we know already those people used Nazi symbols at demonstrations after Oslo that led to the assassination of a prime minister. Does he think we don't know that it was Avishai Raviv and the government's own provocateurs that did that and not us? And then he goes on to describe that, you know, there's a big difference. There's a big difference. They're not being taken in cattle cars. They're not going to be gassed. They're not going to be undressed. And it's men of sugar. It's men of sugar. You know what he doesn't see? If he would stop for a moment defending the Holocaust and start defending Jews, then we would know that he learned something from the Holocaust. These people are in pain. For a year now, they have run one of the most beautiful campaigns on their own behalf. With dignity, with beauty, with creativity, with Mesiras Nefesh, with great organization. And nobody cares. Doesn't he realize that this is a cry of pain? Wait a minute. When I'm finished, you can say... Just one moment.
I will not allow anyone here to interrupt the speaker. There will be a time for questions, and everyone will have decorum.
Rachel turned...
Just out of respect. If anyone feels that they cannot sit until Rabbi Gold finishes speaking to say something, I'm going to ask you to get up and go now. Otherwise, you will have the chance when we finish to ask a question or to make a comment. Period.
Rachel turns to Yaakov and says to Yaakov, famous conversation. Rachel turns to Yaakov and says, Havoli bon and give me children, the imayin, and if not, meso anochi, I'm dead. Is that illogical? Is she mad? Give me children, and if not, I'm dead. So the pasuk says, Vayichar af Yaakov. Yaakov gets angry with her, and he says to her, Hatachat alekim anochi, am I in the place of God who has taken away from you the fruit of the womb? Am I God? Am I the one who denied you children? Now, let's just analyze this conversation. She says to Yaakov, give me children, and if not, I'm dead. I mean, you know, she's sort of accusing Yaakov that Yaakov is going to be the death of her. And this sounds a little bit like incitement. We may need mazuz to look into this. And then Yaakov responds with great intelligence. What do you want from me? I'm God? Am I the one that has denied you children? What does the Medrash say? Brought by the Chamdan. And you know who elaborates on it? The Mesilat Yesharim. We're going to end with the Mesilat Yesharim. The Medrash beautifully says that God turned to Yaakov and said to him, Kach Onin et hamu'ukot, is this how you respond to a woman who's in pain? Don't you understand that this woman is suffering? This outcry of Rachel is out of a sense of frustration and unhappiness and depression. You know how Yaakov should have responded? Rachel, I know it's so difficult for you. Let's say another kapitel tilim. Let's daven together. The Medrash, do you understand the beauty of the Medrash? God says to him, don't you understand? She's in pain. Kach onin es hamu'ukos. This is how you respond to a woman in pain? All the attacks on Gush Katif last week, Kach onin es hamu'ukos. Is this how you respond to Jews who are going to be thrown out of their homes by fellow Jews in Eretz Israel? All the self-righteous defenders of the Shoah. Don't you understand? And you know what the end is? They don't understand the pain of Gush Katif. Binyamin understood the pain of Yosef. Yehuda understands the pain of Yaakov Avinu. Yosef and Binyamin understand each other's pain. But I don't believe that they understand the pain of Gush Katif. I don't think there are many people in government who are losing any sleep over it. Don't you realize that if people do something like this, they need attention, they need somebody to listen to them? So Shevach Weiss can only tell them that you can't use symbols of the Shoah in order to advance your political motives. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Doesn't understand. That's our sixth and final blindness. Not intellectual, not religious, not because it's dark and I can't see. It's an emotional blindness. Something's missing with the Yiddish hearts. I'm going to make one statement now. I don't have the right word to use, so don't jump at me yet. Maybe you'll help me get the right word. I don't know whether the word is admire, respect. You don't know what's coming yet. I'll tell it to you straight. Palestinians who say that we will never end the struggle until every Palestinian returns to his home. I respect that. Do you think it would ever occur to them to remove a Muslim, an Arab, from his home? You're crazy. They're going to demand that everyone goes back home. And we don't have the decency to do that. We can't tell a world that we haven't been able. We're sick. No Jew will ever be removed by a fellow Jew from his home. Certainly not in Eretz Yisrael. What's so difficult about that? Do you understand? You'll see in the paper every few days that there were swastikas on graves in France. We get all shook up. Faxmen of the Anti-Defamation League, everybody gets upset. And there's only one country on the face of this earth where Jews are under threat of being removed from their homes. That's right here. I can't help but admire Palestinians who say every last one is going to get back to his home. And I can't help but being terribly upset by the idea that Jews are going to remove fellow Jews from their homes. That's a blindness. The emotional blindness. It's a blind, not a blind eye, not a blind mind, but a blind heart. There's a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Ha'om ha'holchim b'choshech, a people that goes in darkness, ro or gadol, saw great light. Yoshvei be'edetz tzalmavet, those who live in the shadows of darkness, or noga aleihem, light began to shine on them. Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, a people, it's because they don't know. All they need is or gadol, all of a sudden the light, and they're able to see what's ahead. But the intellectually or the emotionally blind, for them it's going to be a longer process. They are yoshvei be'edetz tzalmavet, they're living in some kind of a never world. Or noga aleihem, it's going to take time until the light shines upon them. There's a machloket by Chanukah. Beit Sham, I say, you light 8 candles the first night. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Beit Hillel say, first night 1, work your way up to 8. I say the difference of opinion is because they're both talking about different kinds of darkness. Beit Shammai is talking about the Mesilat Yesharim's first darkness. People that just don't know what's ahead. It's dark, they can't see. You know what you need? One big burst of light. Ha'om ha'olchim b'choshech, ro or gadol, and all of a sudden you begin to see, you know what's ahead. Then you can diminish the light, you can put it out, we see already what's ahead. But then there are the intellectually and emotionally blind. That's going to be a much more difficult job. That's going to have to be day by day. A little more light, and a little more light, and a little more education, and a little bit more. Until ultimately we hope the day will come that they'll be able to see clearly how a Jewish heart is supposed to feel, how a Jewish head is supposed to work, and how Jewish eyes are supposed to look at our situation here and throughout the world. We can't afford to be blind, because our blindness is that which may put us in grave danger. We have to keep our eyes, our heads, and our hearts open wide. That's it.
Thank you, Rabbi Gerber. Questions or comments?
Yes.
is, about my, first of all, let me tell you that I was very inspired by your talk.
Thank you.
I'm confused about Aza. Is that not true that Aza was never part of historical Israel? The Pishtim set in Aza.
What did you say? It was not part of... What did you say after? Not part of historical Israel?
Not part of historical Eretz Israel. The Pishtim always set in Aza. All our kings always fought with the Pishtim in Aza. Is that not the case?
No. Absolutely not the case at all.
Which tribe got Aza? Okay. Okay, so...
Wait. No. You sing Zmiris Friday night?
Pardon?
You sing Zmiris Friday night?
Yes.
One of the favorite zmiras of all is Yoribom. Yoribom, oh, no lam. I mean, I can sing a few of them. Why? Who wrote Koribom? Rabbi Yisrael Najara. Rabbi Yisrael Najara was the Rav of Aza 600 years ago. The oldest shul in the country is in Aza. Aza is part of biblical Eretz Yisrael 100%.
One of the tribes.
100%. There is absolutely no doubt about it. Anybody who's going to tell you is making one big mistake. I can go into that.
The wall of the land of Israel was effectively conquered by Yeshua.
Plishtim war ultimately.
Yes.
David ultimately.
But when the land was divided up, each tribe was supposed to tend to its own conquest in an area, but not all the land was at
now,
that point.
Remember, one of the five cities of Plishtim was Ashkelon. One of the five cities of Plishtim was Gat. These were all parts of Eretz Yisrael. It took a few hundred years until they conquered it. The only other difference between Aza and the rest of Eretz Yisrael, or for that matter, the same thing can be said about Beit Sham. When Jews came back in the days of Shivat Zion, Ezra and Nehemiah, they did not sanctify all of Eretz Yisrael. Because they wanted to leave certain lands unsanctified so that in Shemitah year, the poor would have some place where to eat from. One of the places was Aza, the other was Beit Sham. You go tell David Levy that Beit Shan is not part of Eretz Israel, and you'll see what you're going to get for that. Go ahead, second question.
Given your answer,
yes,
and given the fact that we know that the same problem of Aza in terms of the huge Palestinian population exists in parts of Yehuda Shomron, how can we solve the demographic problem and still keep a democratic Jewish state?
Now, I'm going to tell you a conversation.
And then after that, I'll nominate you as the IOS or Rashi
Shoshone. You could find a better job. I imagine the following conversation. The conversation took some place sometime at the beginning of May 1948. A few people come to Ben-Gurion and they say, "You're out of your mind? You want to establish a state? We're 600,000 Jews. There are 600 million Arabs out there. I mean, you're crazy. It's a demographic problem. We need to be overwhelmed." Thank God that Ben-Gurion didn't give a hoot about the demographic problem. We wouldn't have had a state of Israel. I said during the course of my remarks that we're a miracle. We will never solve the demographic problem because Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jewish people in Torah, it's not because you're the most numerous of the nations of the world that God desired you. You're the smallest of all of the nations. Moshe said that 3,500 years ago. He was really describing that demographically we are always going to be a minority wherever we are. So now either we live with this idea, which means that we have to remain strong. But if we're going to start worrying about the demographic problem and what will happen if we don't have we don't have Yeshas, so then what do we have? So we'll have a little thin strip with 5 million Jews against, what is it now, 1 billion Muslims in the world? What happened with the demographic problem? There is no solution to the demographic problem except strength. And strength, not only physical strength,
commitment to our state. That's all. We're here to stay. We've been doing it so far. Every time somebody raises the specter of the demographic problem, there's another solution that comes. And by the way, I don't even know why what they want. We're not running the lives of the Palestinians in Yasha. We haven't been doing that for 8 years now, 9 years now. What's the problem? What are the settlers in Yasha? In what way are they interrupting the flow of life in Jenin or in Bethlehem or in Hebron? Kiryat Arba has anything to do with Hebron? What are we doing? They can have their elections despite the fact that there are 250,000 Jews in Yasha. What does it have to do with their elections and their democracy? It's a boogeyman. The whole thing is a boogeyman. Somebody made it up.
Let's take a question.
Go ahead.
Two comments.
Go ahead.
Number one, in terms of the Shoah.
Yes.
I personally had a cerebral feeling that a Shoah was imminent during the period of 2003 when we had all the suicide.
You had the feeling?
I did.
Yeah.
And I think that any Jew who was committed here in Israel, whose ancestors perished in the Holocaust and understood what they went through, had this kind of feeling. So it's not so unusual for the people in Gush Katif to feel this way too, to feel that, to have this feeling of a Shoah type of situation. That's number one. So, I mean, and I would venture to guess that a lot of Jews may not have come here to Israel to visit for that reason, that there was this cerebral feeling that maybe something terrible and imminent was going to happen here. That was one comment. The second comment I had, you didn't get into the root causes of this blindness.
Of
the blindness.
Yes.
And I would like to suggest why this blindness exists today. When we look at the way business is conducted in this country, whether it's in the Knesset, in the business world, in the education world, where the complete sense of moral transparency is absent, there's no sense of values, where families, the number of families that have fallen apart, astronomical. It's no surprise that we have all this blindness. You can't see things with clarity when these kinds of situations exist, and when this absence of values.
You remind me something. And I had written a letter to the editor of the Jerusalem Post. I haven't sent it out yet, against Shevach Weiss's article. But the same day that I read Shevach Weiss's article and the whole country was going crazy about the patches, I saw a number of statements by members of the government. Listen carefully. Rakevet ha-hitnatkut yotzeit la-derech. The train of disengagement is going to go regardless. From which Umschlagplatz is the Rakevet going to go? Rakevet ha-hitnatkut yotzeit la-derech. All the great defenders of the Shoah, the trains are going. They're chugging away and the disengagement is going to take place. That's even uglier than the orange stars. Huh?
It's a very wrong word.
Very wrong word. And been used on many occasions. On many occasions it's been used. It's a terrible word. But you know, it's an Israeli expression when things are going, you know, the rakevet, yahine rakevet, aim is so, yup, the rakevet, I eat my pussy on the way.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes. Okay.
I'd just like to thank you for Joseph Paul, one of my eldest daughter in the family, who have lived 15 years on Gush Katif. And when you ask them how do they feel about the situation, do you really feel threatened by the Nui?
And what
the
is the
answer?
They?
Is Zelo Yikre.
Zelo Yikre. Zelo Yikre.
So we all have to
believe. Yes, one of the fellows in my shul had an anicle in Morag. Mm-hmm. Now the office of the Hitnat Kut is a few blocks away from our house. It's on Kamfein Sharon. So I told them we have to notify the Hitnat Kut. There aren't 8,000. There are 8,001 Jews now in Gush Katif. Yes.
One more question.
Just to clear up, poor lady here, I wasn't trying to say. Shimshon was in Aza.
On Aza, of course.
To conquer, and as Shevet Dan, to conquer the Plishtim, which he did successfully, Baruch Hashem, and if I'm not mistaken, they say that the Mashiach will come through Shimshon, and he was blind with it.
Interesting.
By the way, anybody, I'm glad you introduced this, but I meant to announce it earlier, but anyone who really is interested in studying Tanakh, since most of us missed that, you should come to our Wednesday morning study of Tanakh over breakfast every Wednesday at Cafe Inn, the newly remodeled Cafe Inn, 8:30 to 10 a.m. every Wednesday as we study Tanakh.
Well, I think there are 6 million Jews that were in the wrong place too. If they wouldn't have been there.
No. I don't know.
By the way,
it's very easy to say that.
Did you think the same thing about every time a bus exploded in Yerushalayim? If they just wouldn't have been in Yerushalayim? Every time a bus exploded in Gedera, every time it exploded in Tel Aviv, every time it exploded in Afula, if we wouldn't have had Jews in Afula, Tel Aviv, Yerushalayim, nobody would get killed. I think we should all go back to Rabchitz. I don't know. I'm ready to start building my own community in Poland. Or maybe we can go back to Oman with the Breslovers. Sure, if she wouldn't have been there. Just like my friend Dr. David Applebaum, if he wouldn't have been in Yerushalayim, he'd be alive today. That's right.
And that is, by the way, unfortunately, what a lot of Jews in Kutlaris will tell all of us whenever something happens, wherever we live, we're not.
And by the
way,
yeah.
Been there, yeah. Not
and by the way, there have been more people killed in Yerushalayim in Tel Aviv than in all of Yesha during the last 11 years. So I think we should all move out to Yesha, and our chances of survival are better.
Thank you to Rabbi Gold, and thanks for all of you. If you put your prayers up, that will be a big
Kari, what's your name?
Justin Feldberg. I don't know if we're in. We stay from time to time.
You what?
We stay from time to time in Pesach.